Welcome to the first episode of The Bibliopod, a Maclean's podcast covering the highs and the lows of all things literary. We'll talk books, reading, writers, feuds, gossip, as well as what we love and loathe. I'm Anne Kingston, a writer with Maclean's.
I'm Brian Bethune at Maclean's Magazine. Today we're going to be talking about The Corpse of Canlit, or Is That a Twitch We Detect?, with Stephen Marsh, who will drop by later. Consider the Nature and Pathways of Literary Fame, both for the living and the dead, from Jane Austen to Günter Grass. But first we need to know what we're talking about. Just what do we mean when we talk about books?
Well, certainly it's a topic Stephen Marsh took on this week in the recently launched Partisan magazine, in which he announced that the Canadian literary project, or literary nationalism as we think of it, is dead and due for long overdue for burying.
Right. He didn't seem to be entirely certain whether that was a good idea or not, whether that was a happy outcome.
Well, I think that as Marsh points out in his piece, the burden upon a Canadian novel is considerable. It's very hard to be a novel in this country and be taken seriously. And that's one of the themes he explores when he talks about, Canada Reads and the notion that, a book has to have moral purpose and social import in order to be worthy. And that's a thought that he takes great.
Right. What makes, in the minds of most people, a great Canadian novel? What makes a novel Canadian? What makes it worth talking about? And we seem so often to be, it's another voice. Here's another part of the mosaic or something. Do we actually talk about literary quality when we discuss novels in Canada?
I think there's some institutionalized forces that influence so much about how we read and what we think is worthy. I mean, obviously, a huge one is Canada Reads, which is credited with making Canadians read, as if, getting your daily nutrition sort of thing. And also the prizes.
I think you're right. Just like as though there is a Giller novel, one we can visualize, and a Governor General's novel, for sure, there is a Canada Reads novel.
That's right. And that would be a very worthy book. Listening to it this year, I realized that as someone who grew up in the Canadian school system, reading a lot of Canadian literature, I might be permanently scarred as a reader because I've been taught that it's okay for books to be boring, that a good book can be a boring book as well.
Yeah, the Canada Reads people are essentially engaged in a competition over who has the worthiest tome.
There was one point at which Wab Kanu, the host who did a good job moderating it, actually asked whose book featured the most marginalized characters. And this is what books should be doing.
And this is why we don't write books about the here and now, right? Or about what could be described as ordinary people and ordinary lives, because they don't have a new voice to throw in, we think. If you want to talk about racial persecution in Canadian history, set it in the past.
Oh, it's safe there.
Yes. If you want to talk about transsexuals, for instance, you can set it in the here and now, and you can put it in a YA novel. And you can do very well in the school system over that. But if you have just novels about people, middle-class Torontonians, I don't know if I've seen one lately. But we should ask the man who wrote a book about a literal wolf of Wall Street.
Absolutely. Stephen Marsh is a columnist for Esquire magazine who has written 5 books, including How Shakespeare Changed Everything. His most recent novel is titled The Hunger of the Wolf. He joins us today in the Bibliopod. Stephen, you've come out barreling out of the gate with a piece, an essay in Partisan magazine this week. What was Canadian literature?
Yeah.
You take shots at sacred literary cows in this country. Margaret Atwood, you compare with Lycan, wanting to be anywhere air is good.
But I think that, finish. I'll just...
Thank you.
Okay, yeah.
I will. You take on a particular pet peeve of mine, which is the Canadian impulse to compare Alice Munro Canada's Chekhov. But you also talk about Canadian national literary identity and, pronounce it dead. What
prompted that? Well, first of all, there's a couple of things I would say to start out with. I mean, first of all, lichen is a massive compliment. I mean, to say that someone is like lichen, I mean, it's, there's no higher praise.
That's a Canadian thing, is it?
I mean, well, no. I mean, lichen is one of the great forces in nature. Nothing can kill it. I mean, when the air grows bad, it just stops and then it starts growing again. I mean, it's one of the most ancient primordial life forces on Earth, and it cleans the air. I know this sounds odd, but I really felt this piece was kind of a love letter to something that was dead, but meant a lot to me. And it was certainly not meant to be an attack or a polemic against Canadian literature at all. Just more like a letter to a difficult mother, if you know what I mean, that you love, but is difficult. But it's trying to deal with that love, in fact, really more than a statement of hate, if that makes any sense.
Well, perhaps you should, for those who haven't read the essay, perhaps you could elaborate
It's at partisanmagazine.com, which is just launching. Mm-hmm. We should blurb it, especially since they told me that they're going to give me three drinks for every time I mention
it's a drinking game now.
Yeah, so partisanmagazine.com, they don't know how much I can drink, so they probably don't know how many times I can mention
it. We're at three now? Yeah, okay.
I'm at three, so that's nine beers, so I probably don't need to mention it anymore. We're getting into dangerous territory if I mention partisanmagazine.com one more time. Seriously, though, I mean, I think this is the material that I was taught in school. This is the material that was my introduction to literature proper. I still think it is the national literature, and in the sense that I'm a Canadian and kind of a patriot, I do think that those authors that I was discussing will forever be the nationalist authors. I just think we're in a different world now.
And just to elaborate on that group of authors. Yeah. We're talking about the Canlit canon.
You know, it's a small essay, so I couldn't really bring in, I mean, I could have talked about lots of other authors in it, but I mean, to me, the main line of Canadian literature is Margaret Lawrence, Margaret Atwood, Alice Munro. Those are the three that you can't really, it doesn't make any sense. If you don't mention them, you're not really talking about Canadian literature. So, I mean, there are others. There are certainly tons of others.
Well, how do you figure it's dead then?
How do I figure it's dead? There's two senses that it's dead. One is the institutional program that implied it is dying and collapsing very rapidly. And you just have to look at the fact that there's only one Canadian publisher left, which is Anansi. The rest all belong to the Germans. And trust me, if you talk to publishers, that has meaningful consequences on what they publish. And that, you know, that just means that if you're writing a novel, you're not going to write a Canadian novel that will get published by a Canadian publisher and then maybe go larger. You need to think about other markets and then maybe work yourself into the Canadian market. That's a huge thing. That's a huge phenomenon. But then there's also the decline of Canlit on campuses, the decline of the humanities generally as a national project that we're willing to invest in, the death of the CBC, the general decline of print magazines and print products. All of these things are working towards
not specifically Canadian, but what's going on in the world.
Yes. They matter much more for us when we are in otherwise in a swamp of other people's cultures. I think one thing we can be proud of is how we treat writers. I mean, this is the greatest country to be a writer in anywhere. Period. I mean, it doesn't really matter. Like, writers are all complainers, like born complainers. But like, it's really ridiculous to complain about being a writer in Canada. There's lots of institutions. There's lots of prizes. There's lots of places to publish. There's lots of money.
There is bread and salt.
Right? Like there, and I think, you know, there is. Not to be too harsh about it, but, you know, there is no better country in the world to be a mediocre poet than Canada. I mean, by far. And I don't think we should take any of that for granted. Like, I don't think we should take our peace and prosperity for granted. I mean, there are lots of places in the world where if you want to write something, you're going to be killed. I think we should be proud of that. On the other hand, I think, you know, Canadians don't really actually want to look at the content of their own identity very much. We're actually in a great time to like wave the flag and go around drinking Tim Hortons, even though it's owned by Burger King and all that sort of thing. But when you actually get down to like, well, what is the content here? Like, what is distinctive? If you were to describe to somebody else, what is the distinctive form of Canadian literature? You would have no answer.
Well, but don't you in this essay argue that it's an obsession with landscape itself? And it's true. I mean, that speaks to your earlier point, which is that people aren't really looking inward. They're looking out at this oppressive landscape they need to survive.
When you talk about Canadians don't want to talk about being Canadians, a large part of that is we have no agreement on what that is. And we know very well that we're going to upset somebody else.
Yes, right.
If we start talking about so much of this CanLit project was a, what, Montreal, Toronto, Ottawa axis?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you could say that, but then Marshall McLuhan's from Alberta, right, and Hugh McLennan's from Nova Scotia, and certainly wrote about Nova Scotia. I think it's a, you know, it's
well,
what
you put
Fry
Malcolm
said.
Gladwell and Marshall McLuhan in this.
Yeah.
Well, there are Canadians who write, but are they Canadian writers?
Well, that's my point, really. I mean, I think Malcolm Gladwell is not a Canadian writer. He's a writer. Although it's interesting because, I mean, I think when you read his work, it's like, oh, all you're doing is taking a Canadian perspective on America phenomenon, right, and selling that
it's
to
like
Americans.
The embodiment of that New Yorker cartoon where a woman in a bar says to a guy, you seem slightly strange. Are you a Canadian?
Right, yeah.
Oh, I did want to tell you that I thought you should have called the whole thing The Will to Power of Wingham, Ontario,
right,
which is one of the best lines I've ever read.
Well, I think Alice Munro actually, because of the kind of Canadian willful marginality, like her brutality is really not taken very seriously.
That's right.
And her brutality is really the core of her literary achievement.
Yeah.
And I mean, again, she is a master worker. It's just, I think, particularly outside of Canada, no one really gets the viciousness that she embodies so perfectly as a writer, and which is so incredibly enviable. I mean, Graham Greene said a writer should have an ice in the heart, right?
Right.
And I mean, she is just frozen to the core. It's fantastic, you know.
Hence your contention with the Chekhov comparison.
Yeah, I mean, because Chekhov was, you know, he loved people. Like, he loved human beings. And he saw them as good, ultimately. And she does not.
No.
I mean, she really doesn't.
I want to get back to Malcolm Gladwell, because you use it as a nice opportunity to describe the Canadian spirit. You say our place is on the margins, but not of the margins.
Yeah.
This is a privileged place to be from.
You know, we have an incredibly luxurious lifestyle. I mean, I remember, like, who's it? Barrick, the Barrick Gold chairman. What's his name?
Peter Monk.
When he described, like, moving to Canada and moving to some small town and just seeing huge plates of hot dogs. Like, going to a church picnic or something, and there's just these enormous plates of hot dogs. And I think, you know, that kind of effortless prosperity is really, you know, that is the source of our privilege. On the other hand, how do we get from there to cities, really? From that, like, from this landscape that we have that's so infinite and so rich, like, how do we get to that, to having meaningful cities? That's actually kind of the Canadian crisis, right? And it's the crisis that is in every Canadian city, where you're so close to the wilderness, but you're still trying to be metropolitan, cosmopolitan. I think that, I mean, that was kind of what you see, to me, when you look at the main line of Canadian literature, which is really what I'm talking about here. Alice Munro, Margaret Atwood, Margaret Lawrence, and environs. Because some of the best examples are not them. Like, Bear, to me, is the quintessential, the perfect Canadian novel. You know, what you have is the wilderness and the city, mm-hmm, and both as oppression.
Well, and that's going now because we're losing that middle ground, right? The small town Canadian voice seems to be, you go from downtown Toronto to wilderness thinking. And
yes, although, you know, the Canadian small town story is interesting because it's so, they're almost exclusively, and I mean, I am talking in generalities here. There are exceptions to everything that I'm saying. But, you know, the small town story is one of isolation and alienation and loneliness.
Yeah.
Whereas the American short small town story, like In Our Town by Thornton Wilder, is everybody knows your name. You can't escape because, or in, you know, The Killer Within Me by Jim Thompson, he says the problem with living in a small town is everyone thinks they know who you are, right? Yeah. And so these are very different experiences of the outside.
Do you think it's possible to be a Canadian writer and not write a Canadian novel?
I think that's the only people we're seeing, right? I mean, that's kind of like, you know, when you look at Freedom by Jonathan Franzen, or you look at any book, any of these, like The Interestings by Meg Wolitz or something like that, those are all books about America. They really are. Like, they try to offer a take on America. That's not even counting books like American Pastoral, American Psycho. Like, Americans have no problem. It's automatic if you're writing a novel in America that you're going to write about America. And here I think it's the opposite. If you're writing a novel, you don't ever mention the Canadianness of it, right?
Right. You know, that was a good point you made about the titles, you know?
Yeah, like, I mean, no one would ever write The Canadian Pastoral,
yeah,
right? Like, no one would ever do that.
Well, I think that that is there a commercial imperative in that instinct as well. Let's talk about your novel, because your novel is an interesting example of...
After I wrote this, after I wrote the novel, and then I wrote it, and I thought, wow, this really applies to my own novel. Oh, you were, I am really talking about myself here. It's all...
Yes, you were apparently thinking about Americans in their Atwoodian way stumbling around northern Alberta.
Yeah, I mean, I think the fact that I'm from Alberta actually makes a difference, because I know it sounds odd, but I've always been an outsider to CanLit anyway, right? And particularly Ontario, which I've never, I mean, I've never understood. You know, I've lived here for almost 20 years now, and like Ontario has these like little elaborate WASP codes that you just, like you just can't, you cannot, I mean, and it's not like I'm an idiot either. It's like, you know, I do have a degree in semiotics and then I have another degree in Shakespeare. Like, it's not like I'm bad at analyzing codes. And you just like, you'll be in meetings here and I'll be like, oh my God. It takes 15 minutes after you walk out to remember, oh, they rejected me. You know, like it's so hard to tell. And I really, you know, so to me, the world of Rosedale and the world of Wingham, Ontario are quite foreign. So Alberta and New York are actually, to me, similar places in a way.
Well, we like to, you know, in Canada, there's a certain amount of beating ourselves up over sort of this lack of an epic national narrative that's seen in the States and which you allude to in the piece. Yeah. But I'm just wondering if we don't choose our narratives. And one of those narratives would be this entombed idea of CanLit as encompassing the Margaret Atwoods, the you know, Stephen Leacocks, whoever you want to put in that file. It's very limited. I mean, there's a lot of writers who aren't getting heard or seen or talked about as a result, because we have this prefab notion of what a Canadian story looks like, which might not be something that's particularly interesting.
Look, in any other country in the world, the War of 1812 and the narratives around it, which are crazy military adventures led by ragtag bunches of French Canadians, natives, and English people defending their country against this behemoth from the South, would be, everyone would know every name on in that war. Everyone would know who Tecumseh is. Everyone would know who, I can't even remember. But we don't. And I think the question of why we don't is tied to our you know, perverse connection with Britain and our totally colonial attitude, which we have not escaped and which nationalism has not solved.
Well, you make the great point. There's a great line in the piece that refers to Canada as the only country that does not bristle against its overlords. It's the neighbor that gets the
That's right. The overlords we rely upon.
Yeah, we are feudal. And I think I think that really does have consequences that are pretty far-reaching. I mean, I think we are a colony in search of a metropolis, and that's just a very, you know, I'm not sure it's a negative place. I think it's, when I said it's a privileged place to be from, I mean, I think, you know, Fry said that literature is vegetable, that it's, that grows in soil, and it's not animal, it doesn't walk around. But to me, the most interesting writers that I like are exactly those kind of animal writers who do walk around the world and who do come. And every Canadian writer is in that camp, right?
Maybe Fry was wrong.
Well, I was amazed reading Fry. I mean, I was just blown away by how he was able to predict 50 years of literature in 1954. I mean, it's bizarre. Like, he was able, like, working from these, I mean, it just goes to show you how solid these principles are. Fear of the landscape, fear of the city. Like, just operating on that premise alone, you can predict, you know, you can predict that the immigrant stories that are told here will be told like their English drawing room dramas rather than as epics, which is how they're told in America, which is how they're told virtually everywhere else, right? Mm-hmm. And so, like, it's amazing how consistent that pattern was, I found anyway.
And the instinctive, as you say, not even thought out anti-Americanism, which comes from every end of the spectrum, from, you know, left and right. It's just, It's just there. Like, the history of our spelling in this country is so illuminating.
I know.
We were Americans. We came here with American spelling. We had to have it squashed out of us by the British.
Yeah.
And then 100 years later, we're defending Canadian spelling against Americans.
Except that Alice Monroe books all have American spelling because they're all edited at The New Yorker.
Well, you wrote a piece in 2007, The Tyranny of Canlit, which talked about...
Yeah, that was
about,
long ago.
But some of the same themes recur in this piece. It's obviously a subject that you puzzle over.
I've written about it twice.
Okay, then.
Just to say I'm not an obsessive.
Fair enough.
2007 and then almost 10 years later.
But in that essay, you talked about sort of the Brooklyn style as opposed to, and the Canadian, you mentioned Sheila Hetty as an example of sort of that Brooklyn style, which is obviously a Canadian writer, however, not writing the Canadian novel.
Yeah. Because obviously she's Canadian, and if you ask her, are you Canadian, she'll say definitely yes. She lives in Toronto. But, you know, her success and her, like, first of all, her style and the community, the literary community that she belongs to is in Brooklyn.
So that—
100% that's true.
Then that depends on whether you see the literary process as animal or vegetable.
That's right.
Right.
This is what I think is interesting about our moment. Americans cannot escape America. They cannot. They cannot escape, even the best of them cannot escape the huge
All Americans
gravitational pull of it.
Believe in American exceptionalism,
and
whether
they,
it's good or bad.
And it doesn't matter how smart they are, it doesn't matter how politically left they are, it doesn't matter what. Like, they just cannot escape the pull of that, and they can never, I mean, the beautiful thing about Americans in a way is that they don't really think that anyone isn't American.
Yeah.
You know, like, if you go there, like, they don't really think that you're any different from them. Like, everyone's just an American waiting to happen, right? Everywhere around the world. And that's charming. But, you know, it doesn't make you aware of differences.
You lament the lack of an epic sensibility in this country.
Yeah.
But you do cite two Native writers, Joseph Boyden and Thomas King, as exceptions to that. Do you see them in a fairly small category?
Yeah, I think they are in a small category.
Why do you think they beat the odds?
Well, I think, you know, they're very different writers, first of all. Like, King is absolutely... an essayist and a short story writer. He's not really, he's also not an epic writer, I would say. Boyden has written this huge epic, which is totally fascinating and also is incredibly violent and has a lot of blood and gore and is epic. On the other hand, Boyden is broken up into multiple volumes, right? I mean, you would think a country like Canada would produce, like, you know, a 1,200
word. Well, we don't do them because our central message is, who do you think you are?
Yeah.
I think you established that quite well. I mean, that's my neighbors.
That's right.
The course of my life. And that's much of our literature.
And it's everyone you ever deal with in the industry, right? I mean, it's everyone you ever talk to in any form, in any creative capacity ever. That's the absolute first question that you're asked. Right. So it's, you know, eventually this kind of miasma bleeds into everyone. But now that we're leaving this nationalist moment, and I really do believe it's gone, how is that going to bleed into the writing that we do?
Well, you left the essay with a sense of hope, of rebirth.
Definitely.
What does that look like to you?
Well, to me, it's people like the guys at Partisan Magazine.com.
15.
Because those guys at PartisanMagazine.com, you know, there are lots of, I think there are lots of really great writers in the country, although they're really interesting because they tend to write essays and they tend to be totally transnational in a way that is, like, they just don't care about where something comes from, right? Because partly this is because of Canadian nationalism, but also it's because the internet is a just complete leveler of this space, right? Where it's like, if you are, like, it is literally possible that this magazine, PartisanMagazine.com, where I have published the first thing on it, will get as many readers as if I'd published it on the London Review of Books.
Stephen Marsh, thanks for being here.
Oh, pleasure.
You leave us with hope.
Yeah.
And thanks for the article at PartisanMagazine.com. That'll be three drinks, right?
Well, I don't know, for you, probably.
Well, you have over 20 now, so you ought to invite us.
I'll be fine.
Last week, the news about Günter Grass passing away made it four Nobel Literary Laureates dead in the last 12 months. Each of them, well, three of the four, brought a lot of press attention. The one you didn't hear anything about was a Swede and a poet, Thomas Tranströmer. And this brings to mind what the meaning of fame is for a novelist. The other two were Nadine Gordimer and Gabriel Garcia Marquez. And they all received considerable amount of press, and there are many reasons for that. I did mention that Tranströmer was a Swede and a poet, including the fact that Spanish and English are world-spanning languages, and that Grass, translated entirely into English, was one of the handful of foreign language writers widely known in the Anglosphere. It needs more than literary merit to become entrenched. Gordimer had, and still has, constituencies who value her for far more than her novels, including for her moral courage, feminist critics and readers, and anti-apartheid fighters especially. Garcia Marquez has a long history of quarrels with Yankee imperialism and with Latino dictators. He was a conduit between the Colombian government and its guerrillas. And then there's Grass. The fact he was accepted in his lifetime, have to watch that fame ever after part, we don't actually know, but in his lifetime accepted as a great novelist, is the platform for his fame, not the cause of it. It's what allowed him to hold forth on whatever he wished, and I think that solidified his fame. Like Atwood here, the rules are you can object to his politics, but you can't object to the icon. Doug Ford got into trouble not for saying that Margaret Atwood was wrong about libraries, but for saying he didn't recognize her on the street. But Grass was special. He personified one of those lengthy German words that take a half dozen English to translate, namely coming to terms with the past. He may even have invented it. By the time he got to Crab Walk, the title itself is brilliant. He was capturing a moment of Germans beginning very gingerly to mention the fact they died by the millions too. So I think he was a great writer, but whether that was because he was politically engaged, yes, or because he was a great writer, yes, too. So that's fame today. And let's take the long view at literary fame. Anne and I have been reading a wonderfully thought-provoking book by Heather Jackson, an English professor emeritus at the University of Toronto, called Those Who Write for Immortality. How would you describe this book?
This is a really wonderful book. It is erudite and highly, highly readable. It's an investigation into the Romantic period of literature, specifically in terms of who was left on the dust heap and who survived, who prevailed. It explains that fame is very serendipitous. Merit is necessary, Professor Jackson says, but so many other factors kick into play in terms of whether your relatives, you're on good terms with your relatives in the sense that they will keep your papers.
She found almost two dozen things that came into play some way or other. And she made a kind of algorithm over which ones were important
which
ones weren't. And
Yes, let's talk about some of them because they're not automatically self-evident when you think about what paves way to immortality.
Yeah, and they're useless for telling people now. The advice is no good now because they're so contingent. But if you were able to go back there two centuries and give some advice that people took, we might be as familiar with Barry Cornwall and Mary Brunton now as we are with John Keats and Jane Austen.
Well, I disagree with you a bit. I think that she does offer, what is kind of remarkable about this book is it's a literary study, but it's very relevant today in our celebrity-saturated time. And she talks, this goes back to Gunther Grass. What assures immortality, or one of the things, is not being a one-trick pony, of working across many platforms, of also having your work malleable in terms of the platforms of the day. For instance, she makes that great example about Walter Scott, how he was wonderful for the operatic form.
Exactly.
And whereas Jane Austen was built for cinema, and that's, kind of enabled her mass appeal in the 1940s.
Right, and she doesn't just do cinema. She's good online, too.
Oh, she's exactly.
So she will keep going, and she has an afterlife like nobody else. Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, there's no Ode on a Grecian Urn and Vampires. I mean, she is into pop culture in a way that no one else from her time is.
But in her day, certainly, that could never have been predicted. William Blake, who was another artist who nobody would have heard of, had a series of events not taken place over which he had no control.
And the other odd one that makes sense when you hear about it is Preserve the Decencies. You have to make it into the school books.
Oh, but the thing is, you have to, that, now this is very relevant today when you consider, you know, our tusking about what books are, you know, go into public schools still. But it's not just public schools. You have to appeal to kids and be a legitimate part of university, the canon, so right. to speak.
Yeah, it may not make you famous forever, but you're dead as a doorknob if you don't have it. And it can make you quite well off in your time. I remember reading, to my surprise, that To Kill a Mockingbird was worth over $1 million a year, every year, to Harper Lee.
I mean, what did you take away from the book in terms of how to assure immortality?
The contingency of it, as you say, and the fact that it's not worth worrying about. You can't tell what's going to happen. You can't, too many people write towards a prize now or towards a movie. None of this is going to really matter. You need to write for, she says, for yourself and for your publisher.
Well, one of the things that struck me as interesting was her observation about, well, there are a couple of things. One was the fact that non-readers, the effect non-readers have on the reputation
yes.
of a writer, in the sense that everyone, you know, books that we have not read but have opinions about, and there's
that's
a long
right.
list of those.
We all know what they are, yes.
And who's important and who's not, even though we might not have read their books and right. or enjoyed their books if we had read them.
Austen may be the first world-spanning author who has more fans who have not read her.
There you go. But the other thing, too, is the idea that iconoclastic writers are never appreciated in their time. And it
yeah.
makes you wonder, and I think she raises this question, about shapeshifters, those who challenge systems, they're rejected in their time. And unless someone finds them, we tend to
right.
blend to conformity. We tend to endorse conformity, or we don't want anything to...
And the iconoclasts would be gone if they're not found within the next generation. It's hard to think how you could, after a stretch of a century, bring somebody back. Now, she claims Blake has been brought back, but he was on the brink. He hadn't fallen into the chasm yet.
Well, that's one of the strengths of the book, I think, because she is such a thorough academic. Mm. And I found it incredibly enlightening in terms of the lives of these artists, some of whom, you know, I thought I had studied and knew, and
right.
her insights and just the detail of the work of the
right.
observation is amazing.
To be able to bring some quantification into it, when she says 5,000 poets published between 1770 and 1835, that alone is enough for you to know it's not merit alone. The relationship between the five or six who survive and the almost 5,000 who didn't is not just based on, well, they were all terrible. And that brings up her classic thing, her A and B examples. A being Jane Austen, who has the afterlife we were talking about, and B being Mary Brunton, who sounds like someone I want to go read her novels.
Okay, so that's our assignment for next week then. Create the Mary Brunton Society. That's it for our podcast. Bibliopod is produced by Sarmista Subramanian. The music is by Stephen Scratt and Asher Lenz. We'd like to thank Alan Elliott and Scott Metcalf at 680 for technical assistance. Please join us next time.